The Madison Institute presents a thought-provoking talk given by Shadia Drury at Regina University in Canada. Drury argues that the foreign policy of the Bush administration is based on a naive vision of world dominance.
The shameless trampling on the rules of international order has not enhanced American power or prestige. America's conduct has made her an outlaw in the community of nations.
Tune in to Gulliver and Lilliput, American Foreign Policy in a Neoconservative Age. The following talk, Gulliver and Lilliput, American Foreign Policy in a Neoconservative Age, was given by Shadia Drury, a professor in political science and philosophy at Regina University in Canada. Professor Drury argues that the foreign policy of the Bush administration is based on a misguided understanding of realism, with disastrous consequences. This talk was given on October 1, 2005 in Madison, Wisconsin, and was sponsored by the Madison Institute. Shadia Drury.
Today I want to talk to you about American foreign policy, and I'm going to give not the kind of usual critique of American foreign policy that you expect me to give. I'm not going to criticize it from my liberal perspective, but on the contrary, I'm going to criticize American foreign policy from a political realist perspective, because American foreign policy presents itself as a form of political realism. And I also want to defend a form of political realism, but I think that American foreign policy is based on a naive and simple-minded realism, and I want to show why it's a naive and simple-minded, and that the foreign policy that is inspired by the neoconservatives right now has its source in the ideas of Donald Kagan and Leo Strauss. And those are two of the sources. There are other sources that I discuss in my introduction to the new edition of the political ideas of Leo Strauss, but the two main sources of American foreign policy are from Donald Kagan and Leo Strauss, and I'm going to discuss their ideas and the rationale behind their ideas and their form of political realism. And I'm going to call the two different kinds of political realism that they have. One I'm going to call hyper-realism as opposed to classical realism. And I'm going to defend classical realism. And I'm going to discuss Kagan's ideas as hyper-realism, and I'll discuss Strauss's ideas as sugar-coated realism. So these will have those three types of realism: hyper-realism, sugar-coated realism, and then classical realism, which I'll be defending. But before I do that, I want to say that, just to remind you of some stuff that you're probably quite familiar with, and that is the fact that the whole foreign policy of the new conservatives has been outlined very clearly in a website that is out there for all to see called the Project for the New American Century. And that was basically written long before the Iraq War. It was written during the Clinton administration period, and it was written as an effort on the part of the neoconservatives to influence Bill Clinton to take what they called, you know, American global leadership in the world, and to take opportunity and to take the unmistakable, what they called the unipolar moment in history. And the unipolar moment was the defeat of the Soviet Union. With the Soviet Union gone, America can then play the kind of global leadership that she couldn't play before, because with the Soviet Union gone, now war is possible. Because with the Soviet Union there, war is not possible because of the whole idea of mutual assured destruction. But now they think war is finally possible. And if only we can convince an American administration that this is the case, that we could have several wars going on at the same time, destroying America's enemies in every part of the globe, so as to assure what they call America's global leadership. They also call the Pax Americana, complete American dominance over the weapons of mass destruction. That was the idea, that was the plan, and that this could be done with several wars, they call them theaters of wars, going on at the same time, where they're followed by constabulary operations after that, and the idea being, of course, to destroy all enemies everywhere and to have global hegemony of the United States, a kind of global tyranny of sorts, except, of course, the neoconservatives tend to to think that America is an exception. There is a whole tradition of American exceptionalism that makes this kind of talk about global tyranny, global dominance, to be something that they can express completely with a clear conscience, because they feel America is good, and God is on the side of America, and America is wonderful, and the dominance of America around the world is going to be something not just good for America, of course it'll be good for America, but it'll be good for the world. The world will be so lucky to have America as dominating all the world in this way. So because America is a behemoth, but she's a behemoth with a conscience, supposedly, you see. So that's the sort of the theory that you find people like Donald Kagan. Now, this project for the New American Century was written in 1997, and it was signed by Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, William Bennett, Jeb Bush, Norman Podhoretz, Midge Dekter, Donald Kagan, Dan Quayle, Francis Fukuyama, Irving Kristol, who was the chairman of the project, and many more. So these are the kind of the core neoconservatives, and all of them are playing a huge role in American foreign policy under the Bush administration, because when Bush won, they thought, oh, finally, here is a guy that we can manipulate. Here is a guy that might listen to us. And if he won't listen to us, we can certainly convince him or twist his arm or something. And the tone of the document is what's interesting about it. It's clear, it's urgent, it's bold. A kind of a new, bold foreign policy intended to capture the unipolar moment. In order to create an atmosphere that is favorable to American interests, American principles, and American values. The document actually makes clear recommendations on how to achieve this and how to do this. And the clear recommendations are global missile defense, to defend the homeland, and to create a new military, which is the US Space Forces, and for the control of space, and to strengthen ties to allies to help America defeat her enemies. There's a lot of talk about enemies. Find leaders willing to take on America's global responsibility. They thought that was going to be the biggest problem that they had in 1997, is to find leaders willing to do what they think was necessary to be done. There is absolutely no bashfulness, no secrecy associated with this document. This is not a clandestine plot for world tyranny. It is an opportunity, as they see it, for America and the world. An opportunity for the world to get rid of her dictators and to exchange them for American democracy and its attendant prosperity, what the neocons call regime change. Okay. So the project provides a chilling vision of America's global dominance, and it talks about life as a constant struggle, a perpetual struggle, but the struggle will be won and everyone will eventually be subdued. It's not going to be endless war. They don't imagine that the project on which they are embarking will lead us into endless and perpetual war. They imagine that it's something actually doable and something actually achievable. The watchwords in the whole of the project for the New American Century, the watchwords are things like bold, daring, decisive, quick, global, combat readiness. You know, it's the whole document is intoxicated with power and the glorification of war. There's no modesty, no reserve whatsoever in the spirit of the document. No cautious reserve that is the hallmark of conservative politics. It is a radical political project, and like all radical projects, it reduces politics to a kind of making, like making a dress, making shoes, making a cabinet for your wine, you know, like as if you take kind of stuff, you know, like inanimate stuff, and you build something. And that's the model, the model of making that is behind all radical projects, whether it's Marxist or neoconservative. All radical projects have a model of politics that is built on the concept of making. But politics is not like making, because there is no primordial stuff. You always start with human beings who have desires, who have aspirations, who have ideologies, who have aims and goals that are antithetical to yours. So you don't start with stuff that is just a putty that you can shape any old way. And that's why politics is not like making, it's like action. And so that there are all sorts of actors in the political domain, and these actors act in diverse ways, in having different motivations. And sometimes different motivations might lead them to act in the same way for different motivations. And you find there are different motivations behind the Iraq War, different motivations among the neoconservatives themselves that all lead to them thinking that something like the Iraq War, something like American global dominance is a good thing. But sometimes, because politics is like action and not like making, the results are usually unexpected. It's not like when you design something and you create it and you make it out of fabric or out of wood or out of some stuff. The result is already in your head. You have a vision of what you're going to create and you impose that order on chaos. But that model of imposing order on chaos is an apolitical model because there are a plurality of actors, and these plurality of actors have different intentions, and often the results are antithetical to all of their intentions. So history is not predictable, it's not like making. There's no such thing as Marx thought making history. And there is many ways in which the neoconservatives, because they were Marxists in the first place, before they converted to conservatism, continue to be radical and continue to have a conception of politics as making, which is the quintessential part of radical politics. And they continue also to think of themselves as the vanguard, who are going to make history, that history is something that you make with boldness, with daring, with war, with struggle. And that the rest of the world, the populace, is just a mass, it's just a blob, with no mind, no thought, no intentions and motivations, and they have to be shaped, they have to be given what they need, what they desire by the vanguard being the elite that will guide and lead the people. So all of these are parts of what is very clearly outlined there. And one of the most ominous parts of the documents, an ominous prediction that the authors say that the only thing that is missing in their plan, in their grand plan, is the will to take on the task. And they anticipate that some dreadful catastrophe comparable to Pearl Harbor, and I quote, a dreadful catastrophe comparable to Pearl Harbor will be necessary to awaken America from her military slumber. And the opportunity, of course, materialized with the attacks of September 11th, 2001. And in what this meant was a great opportunity for the neoconservatives to implement their plan, because now they had someone in the White House who would listen to them in the first place, but also they had a great catastrophe by which to say, we have enemies and we want to, that we need to destroy, and we have the military power to do so. Okay, so getting that out of the way, basically the foreign policy that's involved, what is the reasoning behind it? What is the philosophical foundations of this way of thinking? Well, I want to defend a kind of outrageous thesis today, and the outrageous thesis I want to defend is that the thinking behind the neoconservatives is based on a bad interpretation of the story of Jonathan Swift of Gulliver's Travels, where Gulliver is in Lilliput. So I want to say that that is very tempting to compare America's might in the world, and this is one of the things that, you know, inspires the neoconservatives, to compare America's might in the world with the strength of Gulliver vis-a-vis the Lilliputians. And you remember that when Gulliver found himself shipwrecked, he swam to shore, he was very tired, and he fell asleep. And when he woke up, he found himself all tied up by these Lilliputians, because they looked at him and they said, oh, such a giant man, he's scary. Let's tie him up and make sure he's all tied up. So they tied him all, up. And so they were definitely afraid of his power. But of course, you know, their ropes were sort of like little threads that he could ultimately, you know, snap. And so Gulliver really was not afraid of the Lilliputians at all, but he was wary of them because there were so many of them. and he was only one. So the Lilliputians also were so tiny that when they were a nuisance to Gulliver, he was really tempted to grab the first 50 that came within his reach and smash them against the ground. Now, America is treating the world as Gulliver is tempted to treat the Lilliputians. The neoconservative administration assumes that America's unparalleled strength allows her to do whatever she pleases with impunity. They imagine that the laws that apply to others do not apply to the United States. Robert Kagan, one of the leading neoconservatives and one of the people who signed the Project for the New American Century, wrote a book called Of Paradise and Power. And in that book, he states that the concern with justice and with international law are relevant only for the weak. It is a strategy by which the weak try to get their way in the multilateral action that in the world. Sorry, the weak try to get their way in the world. He explains that Europe is concerned with justice and Europe is concerned with multilateral action because she is weak. But since America's strong, she can act unilaterally, with no regard to either international law or world opinion. The strong will do as they please. And this is the doctrine of political realism as understood by Robert Kagan. Now, I think that Gulliver had more sense than thinking that because he was strong and they were weak and the Lilliputians were weak, that he could do whatever he pleased and get away with it and that the Lilliputians would just have to put up with it. Gulliver resisted the temptation to underestimate what Swift calls the intrepidity of these diminutive mortals. He realized that the enmity of the Lilliputians can be dangerous because they were so numerous. Their arrows were like little needles. But there were so many of them that they could easily have blinded Gulliver. So he did not underestimate their collective power. He understood that they could hurt him. And their arrows are just tiny like little needles. And he was very happy that he had his glasses on. You see, he's got his glasses. And it was if it wasn't for his glasses, he would have been blinded. Because even though their arrows are like little needles, there are so many of them coming at him, any of them could have come into his eye and blinded him, right? And so he realized, I mean, that the Lilliputians were very dangerous to him, despite his superiority and despite his strength. Besides, Gulliver realized that he needed sleep, and he could not remain forever vigilant. And we saw the earlier shot where he was asleep, and they were able to do all sorts of things to him. So he couldn't remain forever vigilant against all these hostile little people. He realized that in his sleepy moments, he would be vulnerable to their machinations. So Gulliver could easily have eaten five of the Lilliputians in one mouthful, but he decided to impress them with his clemency instead. He made a point, you know, of walking, you know, very, very carefully, with the utmost circumspection, in order to avoid treading on any of them. He observed the laws and did not make himself an exception to the rules. So American neoconservatives boast of seeing the world as it really is, without rose-colored glasses. They tell us that they are political realists. But do they really see the world without rose-colored glasses? Have they not overestimated American strength? Is it not the case that with all her military might, America could not subdue a powerless country such as Iraq, let alone the whole world? Is it not the case that with all her military might, America could not prevent the devastating attacks of a few terrorists acting independently of state power? This is why, I mean, Gulliver understood that in the way the American neocons do not. This is why Gulliver was careful to observe the laws recognized by the Lilliputians, and he did not make himself an exception to the rules that apply to others. But despite his wisdom, Gulliver found himself in grave danger. One day, a fire broke out in the apartments of the Empress on the palace at Lilliput. Now, he was very, very friendly with the Empress, and the Empress really quite adored him. And you can see that his relations with the Empress were actually quite good. They were, in fact, so good that there was scandal about it. that some kind of sexual relation was going on between Gulliver. That's the part they miss out in the children's textbooks. But in any case, the Empress thought he was something. He was darling because he was so gracious and he was like a gentle giant. And but when the fire broke out in the Empress's apartments, the Lilliputians started to pour water on the fire, and they were grabbing these little tiny pails that were about the size of little thimbles and throwing them on the fire. But the fire they weren't able to quench the fire. And then Gulliver realized not only is the palace going to completely burn down, that the entire Lilliput could be on fire. And so he had this idea all of a sudden. Well, he's going to urinate over the fire, and that's what he does. And he knew that this was considered sacrilegious to urinate over the palace. You know, it was just absolutely not done. It's contrary to the laws. So he was disobeying the laws in doing that. But he thought, well, this is the only way of putting out the fire, with a stream of his urine. So the dreadful noise, the violence of this torrential downpour was just rude. It was impertinent and disrespectful in the extreme. And the laws of Lilliput strictly prohibited such conduct. Nevertheless, Gulliver managed to save the palace from being totally destroyed. But Her Imperial Majesty was not amused. She vowed revenge. Gulliver was forced to flee for his safety. Gulliver's success in putting out the fire was not relevant. The moral of the story is that the end does not justify the means. The means are as important as the end. Using unlawful means to achieve good ends destroys the magnificence and the grandeur of the ends in view. It's my contention that American foreign policy under the new conservatives is based on a perverse interpretation of the story of Gulliver. Now, the two interpreters, and especially the interpretation of the story by Alan Bloom and Leo Strauss. Alan Bloom was the author of The Closing of the American Mind, and he was one of Leo Strauss's most famous students. Now, these two venerated gurus of the neoconservatives, Strauss and Bloom, were fascinated with the story of Gulliver. Not just because sheepish intellectuals tend to have machismo fantasies, you know, but also because the story seemed conducive to their radical elitism. They imagined that the differences between the superior few and the inferior many resembled the differences between Gulliver and the Lilliputians. And they believed that those who are so different could not possibly live by the same rules. What was appropriate for Gulliver was not appropriate for the Lilliputians. They thought that Swift's tale was a justification of differential standards that exempt the superior from the rules that apply to others. They believed that the benefit bestowed on the Lilliputians due to Gulliver's immoral conduct is proof that the superior are exempt from the rules that apply to others. And this is not just the way things are, but they're the way things are meant to be for the good of the world. Now, this way of thinking was intended to justify lies, deception, manipulation, and every manner of unscrupulous conduct by the ruling elite. It was intended to show that there is one natural right, and that's the right of the superior to rule over the inferior in the absence of law. Now, that was the Straussian interpretation, the Straussian reading of the story of Gulliver, but it was a reading that Strauss and Bloom thought should be kept secret. Should be kept secret, in other words, the elite should not overtly go out and say, the way Donald Kagan and Ronald Kagan say, the strong will do as they please, you know, and the weak have to suffer the consequences, that kind of what I'm calling hyper-political realism. But a more what I'm calling sugar-coated political realism is that keeping the reality, the political realism, secret, and saying instead that we are doing what is just and defining justice differently for the superior than for the inferior. The neoconservatives have actually applied the Straussian interpretation of Gulliver to American foreign policy. Accordingly, they imagine that the rules that apply to other nations do not apply to the United States. They imagine that America's strength makes her an exception to the laws of international community. America is free to invade countries at will and to topple governments that displease her because she is an exception, and that is why her transgressions supposedly benefit the world. America is entitled to flout the rules of the international community, not just because she's strong, but for love of the world. As Kagan expresses it, America can power employed under a double standard may be the best means for advancing human progress. And perhaps, he says, the only means, end quote. This is why Kagan maintained that America should support arms control, but not for herself. Yeah. What makes neoconservative realism appealing is that it is laced with a misguided and arrogant immorality that parades as idealism. America is supposedly a behemoth with a conscience. By exempting herself from the rules of the international community, America will benefit the world by replacing tyrannies with democracies. She will save the world just as Gulliver saved Lilliput. But it is instructive to recall what happened to Gulliver. He had to flee in a hurry because there was so much animosity coming from the direction from the empress, from the palace, from everyone in Lilliput that ultimately he had to escape. So there's no doubt that the neoconservative idealism is a source of comfort to President George W. Bush. It makes him feel or believe that bombing civilians, killing 100,000 people in Iraq, mutilating thousands more, torture in the prison in Abu Ghraib and the like, confiscating a country's natural resources, are the justified price for the benefits of democracy. Even if by a stroke of luck or genius, the tyranny of Saddam Hussein is replaced with a moderate democracy limited by law, we can expect the Iraqis to be just about as grateful as the Empress of Lilliput. The immorality and injustice of the war will not be wiped out by any beneficial consequences it might have. And I'm certainly hoping it might, down the road, have some beneficial consequences. The trouble with the neoconservative political realism, it seems to me, is its naivete. Robert Kagan and Leo Strauss are the source of this misguided kind of foreign policy. Let me start with Kagan's hyper-realism. I should say that both Kagan and, this is Donald Kagan I'm talking about now, and Leo Strauss were both fascinated with the Peloponnesian Wars in 400, they started in, they went from 431 BC to 404 BC. They were fascinated with the Peloponnesian Wars, and these are wars described by the ancient historian Thucydides. And they were wars between Sparta on the one hand and Athens on the other. And these are two Greek city-states that were very different from each other. But Athens seems to remind the neoconservatives and conservatives in general of America, because Athens was kind of glitzy. Athens was free and was democratic. I mean, there were slaves in Athens, and the women weren't allowed in the assembly. But relatively, it was considered, you know, the model of direct democracy. All free-born, all free-born male citizens were allowed to come into the assembly and discuss everything and make collective decisions in Athens. And Athens welcomed sophists, it welcomed philosophers, it had beautiful Parthenons, it was very powerful, it had lots of allies, it was always trying to get all the other city-states to join it and to be part of the Athenian Empire in the hope that Athens will defend them against the threat of the Persian threat. And so a lot of the Athenian city-states were allies of Athens in that in that sense, and Athens was extremely powerful and extremely prosperous and a great city and fun, you know, kind of fun to be in. Sparta was the very opposite. It was drab, it was horrid, it was oppressive, it was like a military machine. It had this huge population of people called helots who were basically brutally enslaved, and they were constantly on the verge of revolting. And Sparta basically had to be a kind of military machine in order to prevent the helots from rebellion. So the interesting thing is that Sparta started to feel kind of insecure about all the success of Athens and started the Peloponnesian Wars. So even though Athens was the favorite, Athens was
all the power and strength and prosperity and military might was on the side of Athens. At the end of the story, at the end of the game, Athens lost the war. And this is an interesting and very instructive tale. And the way in which most historians understand the tale is that it's a cautionary tale. A cautionary tale about a beautiful and prosperous city that ultimately lost its freedom, lost its prosperity, was destroyed by an inferior city because she was greedy for empire, because she was overreaching and overambitious, because even though Sparta started the war, during the course of the war, especially after the death of the famous Pericles, who was a very great democratic leader, much more inferior generals happened to come out of Athens, and they just started to see glory, world dominance, all of the kind of things that you find in the project for the new American century. And it's that kind of greed, that kind of overreaching that ultimately led to Athens' demise. But that's a common sense reading of the story as told by Thucydides. But that's not Kagan's reading of the story. Kagan's reading of the story is that Athens lost the war because she did not sufficiently display all of her military might as much as she should have. She should have displayed more of her military might. She did not supposedly use all the force at her disposal. It's a little bit of a far-fetched interpretation, but nevertheless, Kagan takes this interpretation and he applies it to American history, and he's very critical of John F. Kennedy and the Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba. And this you'll recall in the early 60s when some Cuban expatriates who were trained by the CIA invaded Cuba in an effort to take down Castro. And during that invasion, well, John F. Kennedy was kind of leery about it, and he decided not to, you know, they weren't winning against Castro, and the Americans could have put their military might behind this invasion more overtly, but, you know, Kennedy didn't think it was a good idea because, you know, for obvious reasons, the Soviet Union was right there, and in fact, when this happened, the Soviet Union put military bases right in Cuba. And this was caused later on the crisis, the Cuban Missile Crisis, later on. But Kagan thinks that that America lost her power and prestige because she did not fully manifest her military strength during the Bay of Pigs invasion. That she should have manifested her full military strength. Of course, if she did, maybe you and I wouldn't be sitting here to talk about it, you know, had Kagan been the advisor of JFK. But and the neoconservatives actually bore the same kind of reasoning to do with Vietnam. They were great defenders of the Vietnam War, and people like Irving Kristol and William Kristol and the like were defenders of the Vietnam War, and they thought that the reason America did not win the war is because she did not display the full force of her military ability. And so they both see, they all agree, all the new conservatives, Kagan and others, agree that when you don't display your full military might, you lose respect of the world, no matter how, even though you have the power, even though you have the military strength, you lose respect because you are not willing to display it and to show it. And once you lose respect, you lose power. Now that's the Kagan theory that I'm calling hyperrealism, and I want to criticize that theory and say, well, what I think is wrong with the theory, what I think is wrong with the theory is the whole idea of honor and respect, because Kagan thinks that one of the fundamental inspirations for war is the quest for honor and respect. That's one of the fundamental, not just material gain. The material gain is a factor in the rush to war, but honor and respect is an important motivation for war. Now, I think underneath Kagan's whole vision, hyperrealism, is a fallacious view of deference and respect. Power alone and military might alone, without any regard for justice, will not, it seems to me, give a nation the kind of deference and respect that it needs to operate successfully in the international arena. There is a deference that comes from fear and a deference that comes from respect. And those two kinds of deferences are different. Deference that comes from out of fear will give you power, but only as long as you're able to coerce others. But as soon as your back is turned, as soon as you let your guard down, your enemies will vent their hatred and contempt with whatever they have at their disposal. But perpetual vigilance is impossible. And that's something that Gulliver understood in the way that American neocons do not understand. Perpetual vigilance is impossible. So, no amount of military power, no amount of coercion and fear can succeed in ruling others, let alone the whole world. You can coerce only a minority. To rule over a population, you need voluntary compliance. You need the voluntary compliance, in fact, you need the voluntary compliance of the majority. And you can't have that if you disregard justice in dealing with others. Without justice, you can't expect voluntary compliance, which comes from respect and not from fear. We live at a time when America surpasses all other nations in military power. And she has certainly not been reluctant to use her power, but that power alone and the disposition to use it has not given her respect or security. Americans are perhaps more vulnerable than any other people, both at home and abroad, despite all of their power. Now, far from being profound and sophisticated, Kagan's hyperrealism is simple-minded and naive. A more sophisticated version of political realism would follow the classical realism of Hobbes. Hobbes was a 17th century English political writer who compared international affairs to a lawless state of nature, in which there is an endless struggle for power after power, ending only in death. In Hobbes's state of nature, no one, no matter how powerful, is secure. The most powerful individuals need to sleep or relax, at which point they are vulnerable to the machinations of the weak. The weakest person in the state of nature can kill the strongest. This is why Hobbes did not endorse the view that justice is appealing only to the weak, as the sophists believed and as Kagan seems to think, that Europe is weak. This is why she cares about justice. But America doesn't have to worry about international justice or international law. This is, in fact, what the attacks of September 11 illustrate. They illustrate that the weakest can kill the strongest. They illustrate what is true for Gulliver and what is true for Hobbes and what is true for classical political realism, that the weakest can kill the strongest. Military might alone cannot guarantee security. Even the most powerful nation needs allies. Even the most powerful nation needs to deal more equitably with the powerless and disenfranchised to avoid too many manifestations of their rage. Okay, now, not all neoconservatives are satisfied with this hyperrealism of Kagan. Neoconservatives are not all of one mind, and they converge on the same policies, but the rationale behind it is not always the same. So they're not all convinced that hyperrealism is the right thing, namely, the strong will do what they wish, the weak have to suffer the consequences. This is the Kagan line. Many of the neoconservatives would like a more sugar-coated realism of the kind of realism that I associate with Leo Strauss and Alan Bloom. Again, they were obsessed with the story of Athens and Sparta and the war between them. But the Straussian interpretation of what happened in that war is that the Spartans lost in the first part of the war because they started the war and they were aggressive and they felt badly about it. They felt that the gods were not on their side. This is why they lost. Later on, they were convinced the gods were on their side because Athens was becoming so impertinent and so aggressive and so disgusting. They felt the gods were on their side and then they won. So the Straussian reading of the story is that the reason for military success is belief that the gods on your side, that your country is on the side of, that your country is on the side of justice and truth and goodness, and that God is working his magic through you. So what a country needs, according to Strauss and Bloom, then they were not religious at all. They thought of religion as a pious fraud, but they thought, you know, we need those kind of pious frauds for military success and for success, for political success in general, that every society needs myths, illusions, and pious frauds if it hopes to be successful. And the pious frauds had to be really good. They couldn't be just sort of petty lies. They had to be something grandiose, something magnificent and majestic, something sublime and splendid, something like Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, you know, something like that. You find that the speeches of George W. Bush radiate with this religious kind of self-righteousness. His language is filled with references to God, Satan, and the axis of evil. America is God's country, God's on her side, and her enemies are on the side of Satan. By conquering her enemies, she will conquer evil. And those who are not willing to support her are, in George Bush's words, complicit in the war against civilization. Now, in conclusion, my criticisms of neoconservative foreign policy are as follows. First, I will start with the sugar-coated realism that I've just described. The sugar-coated realism that the neoconservatives inherited from Strauss, it seems to me much worse than honest, open, unpretentious realism, even the hyper-realism of Kagan. Because when political realism assumes a religious facade, it becomes impervious to debate. It becomes difficult to convince those in the grip of sugar-coated realism that it is not in their interest to act unilaterally and in violation of the law of nations. When realism appears in the guise of a sacred doctrine, it defies any appeal to reason, justice, prudence, expediency, all the sorts of arguments that, for example, deterred the Athenians in attacking Mytilene, for example, in certain aspects of the war. Some of the what's fascinating about reading Thucydides is he doesn't describe what happened. He tells you what speeches were made to justify what people were going to do. So he doesn't just describe what happens. He imagines what kind of diplomacy went on behind the scenes all the time. And there was a lot of argument in Athens about whether or not it's right for Athens to pursue this aggressive military policy. And a lot of the arguments against the aggressive military policy had nothing to do with religion. They had to do with, it's not wise, it's not prudent, it's not good for us, it's going to destroy us, that kind of prudential arguments. But you can't use those prudential arguments once you believe, as Sparta believes, as Strauss believes, as some of the religious neocons believe, that God's on your side and that you're doing your duty, that killing becomes a matter of course, not open to dispute. Now, secondly, the sugar-coated realism of Strauss conceals the conflict between American interests and American ideals. It conceals the fact that there are hard choices and that we must often choose between our interests on one hand and our ideals, values, and principles on the other. For example, in pursuit of her interests, the United States opposed the democratically elected leader of Iran, who wanted to nationalize the oil companies. Instead, the United States installed the brutal puppet regime of the Shah Pahlavi. I think this was in 1953. Now, similar tales can be told in Guatemala, in Congo, in Algeria. Crude realists have no objections because they are willing to support whoever serves the interests of the nation. But the sugar-coated realists want the interests of the nation to coincide with her ideals and values. And definitely George Bush belongs to these sugar-coated realists. He wants the interests of the nations to be completely coincide, and he always says that. In fact, in his second inaugural address, he said, the interests of America have now coincide with her values and her principles, as if to say the world has suddenly changed and there are no difficult conflicts anymore. If it was that simple, we wouldn't need politicians. We wouldn't need the art of politics, for that matter. But this is not always possible for our interests and our values to coincide with our interests. As a result, a great deal of spin is necessary for the neoconservatives to conceal that conflict. That conflict is real. That conflict will always be there. And sometimes we have to choose between our values and principles on one hand or our interests on the other. If we always choose our interests, we're going to be in trouble. Sometimes we have to choose to sacrifice our interests for the sake of our values and principles. Okay? And these are difficult choices for politicians. politicians to make, but these are the kinds of things that politicians have to do. The harmony between our interests on the one hand and our principles and values on the other does not exist, is very frequently not there. The neoconservatives are convinced that this harmony is there, they declare it to be there, and every time there is a conflict, they have to provide all this lies and spin to show that there is no conflict. So the extensive need for spin is particularly salient during the invasion of Iraq. The neoconservatives wanted to give Iraq the gift of democracy, but only Shiite clerics had any popular support in Iraq. And a democracy controlled by Shiite clerics is not likely to serve American interests. It's going to be allied with Iran, and Iran is so pleased by what Americans have done in Iraq, beyond their wildest dreams, to have their people now in power. And they have to thank America for that. And a democracy controlled by Shiite clerics is not likely to serve American interests. Besides, the enthusiasm of the neoconservatives for religion in politics makes it hypocritical to object to an Islamic state that was democratically elected. After all, the neoconservatives are enthusiastic supporters of the Jewish state, and they have every hope that someday America will be a much more Christian country. Thirdly, by adopting the Straussian blending of religion and politics, and this is my I think, more serious criticism of the neocons, the neoconservatives make it hard to distinguish America from her Islamic fundamentalist enemies. Both are in the grip of a jihadist mentality, which finds life meaningless and insipid if it is not a jihad. As I have argued elsewhere, the neoconservatives, that's in My Terror and Civilization, the neoconservatives' relationship to Islamic societies is not just one of hatred, but one of envy. Taking their cue from Strauss, the neoconservatives envy the fervent zeal that animates their less powerful Islamic enemies. Nothing represents the Straussian ideal of political health more than the crazed Islamic youth we see on television, young men ready to immolate themselves on the split of a moment. Strauss admired those who are willing to die, even for a hopeless cause, and he admired, and there seems to be no shortage of such youth in Iraq as in Palestine. In contrast, the American troops criticize the judgment of their commander-in-chief, they suffer from post-traumatic syndrome, they seek asylum in Canada, and they complain about the length of their stay in Iraq. All this convinced the neoconservatives that American liberal society has made Americans soft, pampered, and without conviction. But it would have been more reasonable, I think, to question the validity of a war launched in the name of democratic evangelism. It would have been more reasonable to decry Islamic fanaticism instead of envying it and wishing to emulate it. And it would have been wiser to search for a source of strength that is not as mindless or as fanatical as religious zeal. So in short, by repudiating liberalism and longing for the closed society, the neoconservatives rob America of her modernity, which is the source of her appeal. And it's precisely these modern qualities, openness, freedom, individuality, plurality, innovation, experimentation, playfulness, and unwillingness to take herself too seriously that made America so alluring to the old world, a world engulfed in dogma, negativity, and everlasting gloom. It's her seductive appeal and not her military might that made America a formidable enemy and continues to be a formidable enemy to the Islamic world. Thank you.
Next, we hear questions and comments from the audience and responses by Shadia Drury.
We're here this morning in the first floor of the State Historical Society of Wisconsin. It's that State Historical Society that provided all the primary documents for what became the Wisconsin School, the revisionist school of U.S. foreign policy, William Appleman Williams and all his students.
I'm honored to be here.
They taught us that the continuities in U.S. foreign policy are fundamentally more important than the breaks. That is, history of U.S. interventionism did not begin in the year 2000. When the United States grabbed the Philippines in 1898 from Spain and then waged a war against the resistance, William McKinley knelt on the floor in the Oval Office and prayed to God for some enlightenment, and clothed that entire invasion, which killed a tenth of the Filipino population, in the rhetoric of democracy, civilization, white man's burden, American mission ordained by God. That's always been a rhetoric of U.S. foreign policy. One further comment. The definition of radicalism, which you are utilizing, is synonymous simply with extremism. Radicalism in the classical sense means going to the root of what motivates and drives society is the basis for radical thinking. Quite contrary to the dark side of conservatism, a reactionary worldview.
I appreciate your desire to keep the word radical for the left. Radicalism just means extreme, immodest desire to transform the world, whether you want to transform it by pushing it forward or turning the clock back, which is what the neoconservatives want to do. Either way, it's radical. So I'm criticizing radicalism from the point of view of conservatism, classic conservatism, which says that you should be cautious of change. Change often, especially when it's radical, brings along with it all sorts of unexpected, you know, bad surprises. That's the conservative view of the world. And I think that a conservative spirit is an important spirit to have in every liberal society, because liberalism has a radical tendency to it. There's no end to all of the freedom that we can keep achieving, and no end to all of the improvements that we can keep making. And there has to be kind of a balance, a conservative kind of spirit that says, hey, hold on, maybe if we change this, we'll get some other not so great things coming along with that improvement. So that caution and reserve about change is what the conservative spirit is. So I am not wanting to reserve the word radical just for the left. I think radical can be left or right, as long as, except you want to call one radical, one reactionary, you know, that's fine with me. But either one is not moderate, and is not moderate, and is not cautious of change the way in which a conservative spirit is. And what I'm saying is that Bush and company are not conservatives by any stretch of the imagination. They are radicals, even if their radicalism is a reactionary kind of radicalism that they want to turn the clock back.
My question is about American exceptionalism. It seems to me, I would argue at least, that the American exceptionalism typifies both the right and the left in America. The right, their American exceptionalism, we're exceptionally good.
Yeah.
And our policies are good, so if we spread them, that's good. The left, we're exceptionally bad. We're not like other empires. We're not, you know, we're somehow exceptionally, uniquely bad. Howard Zinn. So I wonder if you think we're exceptional in any way.
Oh, I think we Canadians are totally in love with America. There's no doubt about it. I mean, it's a poster child for all liberals like myself. But as far as exceptionalism is that America is this Zion that will light up all the world. America is the city on the hill. It's the model for the world. That kind of idea, that kind of optimism that came with the new world. It's part of American philosophy on the left and on the right. The difference, I don't think, is that the left thinks America is exceptionally bad and the right thinks exceptionally good. I think both think the same. They both think America is exceptionally good. The right thinks that it's exceptionally good and it's acting exactly the way an exceptionally good place should act. The left thinks it's exceptionally good, but it's betraying its exceptionally good principles.
Neoconservatives of Jewish background reconcile the fact that they are encouraging Christian extremism, which goes against the lesson of history. But they seem to be unaware that they might be unleashing a monster that they can't control.
Most Jewish Americans support a liberal secular democracy where there is a separation of church and state, where there's a separation of religion and politics, and they feel that kind of separation is really what will protect them from the kind of hostility and the kind of persecution that they have met at the hands of the Church, of the Catholic Church, and of Christianity, and then the Nazis. But the neoconservatives, I think, have been convinced by Strauss and company that religion is absolutely so essential for the health and well-being of a society that they're willing to risk pogroms. That's how much they believe in the necessity of religion, because when they preach religion and politics, they realize that the dominant religion is not going to be Judaism. It's going to be Christianity, in which case it does put them at a risk. But they're willing to take the risk rather than live in a secular liberal society. That's the extent to which they hate secular liberalism.
I know that professors, having been one, are famous for outlining the problem, but not necessarily outlining any ways of getting out of the problem. Professor, what's a person to do?
If I have the opportunity to advise any elite in power, I would say abandon the whole quest for global democracy and instead defend the liberal elements of the liberal democratic regime. The trouble is that the neoconservatives believe in democracy, but not in liberalism. They believe in democracy simply for the reason that they believe that America has been ruled by a liberal elite for too long, and that they want to gamble on populism and democracy because they want to gamble that the people are more conservative than their parchment regime, than their constitution, than their Bill of Rights, than all of these, they want to gamble on that. And liberalism and democracy are two different aspects of our tradition. Democracy is about the rule of the majority, whereas the liberal elements of our liberal democracy are elements that put limits on majority rule. Things like separation of powers, protection of minority rights, limits on executive power. These are rule of law and the like. And if I was to advise an administration, I would say they should try to promote the liberal dimensions of our regime, in other countries, try to promote it not with bombs and guns, but sort of subtly by providing funds and propaganda or whatever to people in those countries who are on our side as far as being more liberal. Iran is potentially one of our greatest allies in the sense that it has experienced a revolution, it has a democratically elected theocracy, now it's experienced the pain and horror of theocratic rule, and now they know that to move in the direction of liberalism is exactly what they want, but they're afraid to do it because to say so openly is to say you're aligning yourself with the colonial power of the Americans and that you want your country to get bombed. It's very, very difficult for Iranian radicals to know how to proceed precisely because of the posture that America is taking. But in fact, people like Iranians now are realized that they want to get the mullahs out of politics. They want the separation of politics and religion. They want individual rights, and they want constitutional guarantees, and they want separation of powers. They want many of these things that are the elements of our liberal regime. The trouble with the neoconservatives, in my view, is they don't believe in the liberal elements of the regime, and they have done everything in their power to undermine the liberal elements of the regime in favor of the democratic and populist elements of the regime.
In conclusion, I want to say that all this talk about God in neoconservatism doesn't fool anyone, that contrary to the expectations of the neoconservatives, the shameless trampling on the rules of international order has not enhanced American power or prestige. America's conduct has made her an outlaw in the community of nations. The blatant rejection of the minimal test of morality, namely that it must be universalizable, that whatever is right for us to do must be right for others to do, has caused America grief. And that kind of blatant rejection of universalism is at the heart of the hyper-realism that I've been describing. It has given
America's terrorist enemies the moral high ground. And that has no doubt enhanced the recruitment and the resolve of the suicide bombers. And it's altogether unwise, it seems to me, to underestimate what Jonathan Swift called the intrepidity of these diminutive little mortals.
Okay. Professor Drury is author of the book The Political Ideas of Leo Strauss, and most recently of Terror and Civilization. CDs and audio tapes of this and other thought-provoking programs are available from the Madison Institute. Please write us at P.O. Box 5304, Madison, Wisconsin, 53705, or visit our website at www.themadisoninstitute.org. The views expressed here are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the sponsor.